What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guests today are Leanne and Thomas Mark Zellog, naturalists, authors, photographers, and filmmakers whose 40 years together have made a kind of creative celebration of living and interpreting aspects of life in Maine, evoked as spirit. Indeed, the elusive focus of this program, through life experience, words and images, moving and still. Their publications include One Point of View, 14 Years at a Maine Lighthouse, a document of their living at Marshall Point Lighthouse in Port Claude, and By a Maine River, A Year of Looking Closely, a comparable investigation of living in a new home in an inland forest ecosystem in Whitefield. Over the past 10 years, they've been collaborating on a new feature-length wildlife film, A Piece of Forest, filmed entirely in Maine, a portrait of how nature shapes and supports who we are, how we live, and what a special place in which we live. Leanne and Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us here.
Well, it's a joy. When I first saw your film, I jumped to all sorts of conclusions. And then as I began to explore in lore about how your work had unfolded, where you had lived, how that landscape had informed the work that you were doing, it became something more than a kind of predictable documentary film of birds in the woods and, you know, the moose grazing in the pond. And I began to think of this as a documentary of a landscape, but also a documentary of a couple's life together, and that the values that were inherent in being able to do that was exactly what this program is supposed to be about. So I usually begin at the beginning, and I'd like to hear where each of you came from, and then, of course, the story of the great romance. How did you meet, when, how, etc.
Lee's got that story down pat, so we'll have her answer that one.
You want me to answer for you, too?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I love Tom's story. I love our story, but I really love Tom's story. He grew up in downtown Manchester, New Hampshire, in a large family, and was often kind of lost amongst all the chaos of a large family. And when he was 5 years old, he used to take little mini vacations. And he would walk a couple of blocks to the Merrimack River in Manchester, and sit on the banks of the Merrimack River with a little journal and write about first-time wildlife sightings that he saw at that tender age when he fell in love with wildlife.
Wow.
As he grew up, he had three older brothers who were very influential and took him wherever they would go, and he looked up to them. And as he grew, he continued to just love wildlife and nature and would explore around Manchester as much as he could to discover wildlife. In his teens, his brothers took him hunting for the first time. And he shot a
woodchuck.
And he proceeded to cry.
Mm.
And at that point in time, he put his gun down and picked up a camera and started shooting with a camera instead.
Wow.
He looked at lots of magazines when he was growing up, National Geographic, among others, saying to himself, somebody's got to be taking these photographs. Why can't I?
There is a kind of a wonderful capturing element of it. And to have learned it so quickly and so deeply, so early, is kind of a wonderful thing. But in fact, hunters, it's the same thing. In order to get that photograph, in fact, you probably have to be more careful and more aware, and more quiet, and more attuned to the landscape where the animals live.
Absolutely.
For you to actually be successful in the hunt.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very true. Wildlife photography is much, much more difficult than just normally hunting.
Right. And when you were young and you were discovered this thing, did you keep little animals in boxes and cages, and did you collect beetles and...
I did to a certain extent. I once saved up my pennies and nickels and purchased a lizard and had a little aquarium for it to survive, except I accidentally killed it. And, of course, that saddened me. And since then, I just have not had the courage to have another wild animal as a pet. I don't think wild animals should be pets, period. But, you know, that's not going to happen. Mankind is going to always have animals as friends and pets. But, you know, when Leah told the story about me shooting this woodchuck, to this day, and I'm 66 years old, I think that happened when I was probably 16 or 17 years old. I can vividly see that image of that day. I can see the shotgun. I can smell the gunpowder. I can vividly see the bright red of the blood flowing out of the animal. This happened a long time ago.
Well, it's mythic. I mean, how many boys hunting with brothers and sons have, you know, been in that point where their foreheads have been marked with blood and you've entered into manhood.
Yeah.
And all these cliches and expectations are placed upon you.
Yeah.
And you didn't bite.
No, I didn't, which really surprised me, because at that tender age, I wanted to be like my brothers. I wanted to go wherever they went. I was so much in tune with them and so much in love with them. And this was, I think, one of the very first times that I rebelled.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not going to do this. I love you guys and I love being with you, but I can't do this.
So the camera you got, the first camera, was what, a point and shoot?
No, it was, well, I did have a point and shoot that I used. That would be the first camera that I used, but it was not mine. The first camera that I purchased was a 35mm camera. It was a relatively cheap one. It came with one simple lens. I recall getting on my hands and knees and trying to hide from wildlife at that age, and with that camera, trying to get these photographs of mourning doves and chipmunks, and all I had was a normal lens. It wasn't a telephoto lens. And I'd get 20 feet from some of these animals, extraordinarily close. At least I thought at that time it was extraordinarily close. And I'd be shooting these photographs with this normal lens. And then I'd get the film back and show the pictures to people. And I'd say, hey, see the mourning dove? I worked 2 hours to get this photograph of the mourning dove. And they literally couldn't see the dove in the photograph. So those were my first forays into wildlife photography.
A doveless photograph of a dove.
Yeah.
So did you have formal training after that?
No, I did not. I am self-taught. Trial and error. And I like to read. But no one has taught me anything.
I will just add, because he's very humble, he mastered the art of film photography. Mm-hmm. And he, as Tom said, he's self-taught.
When we were doing the production for the film, A Piece of Forest, we did seek out assistance, because this was our first foray into filmmaking, and we did need help. And we sought out a post-production company in Portland, Maine, but they eventually quit on us. I'm not sure the reason. It was during COVID, so maybe they had a legitimate reason, but they just quit on us in the middle of the project, which was extremely disheartening.
I bet.
We were pretty close to just closing it up and saying that, you know, we this is ridiculous. We can't get people to help us. We don't know where to get the answers to some of these questions that we needed. Lee said, Tom, do it yourself. Let's do this ourselves. Buy the software, invest in the software, invest in the hardware. We can do this ourselves. Well, that was easy for her to say, because I did most of the computer work, you know, the post-production.
But he's so good about self-teaching himself. That's where I found the faith in him, that he could do it, because I've seen him do it before, and it was such a personal project.
Well, self-reliance.
Yeah. Right.
Let's mark that, check.
Yeah.
Now, Leanne, let's talk about you. Where did you come from?
Well, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. Also lived in Chicago with my family, but I've been in Maine for over 50 years. So although I'm still considered from away, Maine is my home. I love it here, and I can't imagine being anywhere else. And I'm very thankful for my family, my parents, bringing me here. Mm-hmm. But because I was from Pittsburgh and Chicago and lived in cities, you know, I was oblivious to the natural world. Mm-hmm. And then when I was old enough and I started my own career, I was racing through life. And now I look back and I think, you know, who was I racing with? Who was I trying to get ahead of? And then I met a gentleman named Tom Zelog. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as you know, he's been in love with nature and wildlife his entire life. And Tom opened my eyes to the natural world. Mm-hmm. He, I would go when we were dating, I would accompany him when he'd go out into the field and I'd watch him and he taught me how to.
I needed someone to carry my tripod.
Oh, chauvinist, check.
Check, yes.
He didn't succeed. I didn't carry his tripods.
But Leon, you were susceptible.
Yeah.
You were a seeker yourself. You were in this new environment.
Yes.
Did you have a profession? Did you get trained to be a racer?
Well, my background is in marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was a very, very, very hard worker. He was always, had a lot of initiative, a lot of creativity. He was a go-getter. So I think I get a lot of that from my dad just mm-hmm. naturally. Mm-hmm. But when I met Tom and when I accompanied him in the field, I watched him. I listened to nature. I observed my surroundings, observed things that I never even imagined. And so I really credit Tom for opening my eyes to the natural world. And Mother Nature then took over and opened my heart. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can say the rest is history, but, you know, our life has been an incredible love story between the two of us and Mother Nature. And
so let's go to the lighthouse. Let's go to Port Clyde. How in the world did you ever get there?
It was just being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, well.
We didn't know anybody in the community. We became aware that the town was going to rehabilitate the keeper's house and turn the second floor into an apartment, a keeper's quarters, and then the first floor would be a museum. Leanne became a member of the restoration committee for the lighthouse, and during one of the meetings, she learned that they had to begin a search for a tenant for the second floor keeper's apartment. Lee came home after that meeting and said, they're looking for someone to live in this lighthouse. Can we live in this lighthouse?
Can I just interrupt? There's a very important piece of the story that goes before. And that is when I was 6 years old, my parents, we lived in Chicago at the time. My parents wanted me and my brother to see the ocean. They took us to Cape Cod and in Chatham. And I saw my first lighthouse, Chatham Lighthouse. I don't know what it was about that lighthouse. I don't know if it was the light, the foghorn. I remember standing on the beach at night with my parents and seeing the light shine across the ocean in sweeping views. Something called me. I fell in love with lighthouses. And I said to my parents on that trip, when I grow up, I want to live in a lighthouse. And they said, isn't she a cute little girl?
She's cute, that's why.
When I was 18 years old, I never gave up on that. When I was 18 years old, I went to the Coast Guard recruiting station in Bangor, because we lived outside of Bangor at the time. I said, I'd like to join the Coast Guard. I'd like to live in a lighthouse. And they laughed at me. They said, well, we'd love to have you consider joining the Coast Guard, but that was the time where lighthouses were becoming automated and so on and so forth. And I said, okay, well, thanks, but no thanks. And I kind of gave up on my dream, but never forgot it.
Right.
But then, as Tom said, we were living in Mid-Coast, and I found out about Marshall Point and started becoming involved. I thought, if I can't live in a lighthouse, I'll help restore one. So you can take it from there. So now I came running home to Tom and I said, hey, do you think we could live here?
Well, she proceeded to write a letter to the gentleman who was responsible for obtaining a tenant. And within minutes of receiving the letter, he phoned Leanne and said, if you wanted to live there, why don't you just tell us during one of our meetings?
And he said, as far as I'm concerned, it's yours.
And it was ours.
How long did you live there?
14 years.
14 years.
And
So it truly was a dream come true. Truly. And the other piece I just want to say was truly a dream come true for me, a lifelong dream. But also, Lighthouses, when we first met, we met in Manchester, New Hampshire. I was working there. When we first met, Lighthouses were a mutual subject that brought us together. And our second date, we went to Nubble Lighthouse in York. And we sat in the parking lot, like many people do, and just admired the beautiful surroundings. And I said to Tom on that second date, I said, you know, I've always had a dream of living in a lighthouse.
So you moved in. How did you live? How did you make a living? What was your day?
Well, Lee was a banker.
Yeah.
And I was a when I first moved into the lighthouse, I was a staff photographer for a newspaper. Then eventually I switched over completely freelance photography. So that's how we made our living. We weren't official light keepers, but in a unique way, in some small way, we still were light keepers. Mm-hmm. We had a key to the light tower. Mm-hmm. And the reason we had a key is that when the light tower or the foghorn malfunctioned, we would contact the Coast Guard, which was in Southwest Harbor. And on the phone, we would try to repair the fog horn or the light. The Coast Guard on the phone would give us instructions on how to try different things. And sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. When it didn't work, the Coast Guard had to travel 5 hours round trip. That was the main reason why they gave us a key, so that we could help them avoid having to take that 5 hour round trip to push a couple reset buttons or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in some small way, we were still light keepers.
Mm-hmm. And very honored to be.
If you're just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists, makers and exemplars, whose work, specific to the Maine landscape and culture, gives insight into our special quality of life. My guests today are Leanne and Tom Zelog, and we are discussing their new feature-length film on the wildlife and wilderness in Maine, as well as their previous publications on living by the sea and along a river course, ocean, inland water, and forest, three distinct ecosystems so specific and essential to the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfurs.org. So out of it came the book. Tell me about how that evolved. I mean, this was your first book, I suspect.
It was our first book where we were the authors also. We had already had a couple of other books published prior to that, but we were just the photographers. We were the photographer for the Compass American Guide to Maine and the Compass American Guide to New Hampshire, and both books are the world's widest distributed books on the subject of Maine and New Hampshire.
So when we moved to Marshall Point, it was, as I said, it was a dream come true, but we knew we were embarking on something very special, especially Tom. Tom has always been documenting life, wildlife in particular, but he knew we were embarking on something very special, living on, you know, the edge of the continent. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing he did is he bought us some journals. Not that we wrote in them every day, but we wanted to make sure we recorded, because we had no idea how long we would be there. He wanted to make sure we recorded special sightings, events, experiences, storms, people. And so he bought us a journal, and we ended up, in the 14 years we were there, I think we have 11 or 12 of these journals. And so, and then in addition to writing, of course, Tom being a photographer, you know, that was a dream come true for him. Every morning was, ooh, what am I going to get to photograph today?
You know, it was not uncommon for me to open a window in our second floor apartment and create a photograph from that window that most photographers would drool over obtaining.
And travel thousands
exactly.
of miles.
Right. I mean, it was an artist's dream come true. Just an amazing place to live.
So let's distill out from the edge, from the ocean's edge, Maine's unique characteristic. What did that experience teach you? And I assume that was recorded, that those kinds of thoughts or conclusions are recorded in the text of the book. But could you distill out some of the key points from that particular experience?
Well, for me, it continued my growth, evolution, appreciation, love of our natural world. Mm-hmm. Not only the wildlife that we were encountering, the seals, occasional whale, the birds, the eider ducks, just an abundance of wildlife, helped me appreciate the wildlife even more. And for me personally, it really helped me slow my pace. Remember I said earlier I was racing through life? I learned there to really appreciate every day of life.
What about you, Tom? What would you have pulled out of that experience?
I think the emotions that I've experienced every single day. Think about it. For 14 years, every day, it was like living in a dream. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't be sad living in a lighthouse. And to do this for 14 years is just simply stunning. I grew up in the middle of a relatively large city, surrounded by buildings, never saw the sunrise, never saw the sunset, and here I am at Marshall Point, in one of the most spectacular locations in the world, no doubt, and I'm living here, and I'm watching the moonrise, and I'm watching the sunset, and I'm sitting on my Baco lounge in my home doing this. To give you another example.
Every lighthouse keeper's house should have a Baco lounge. That's
one day. One day I was sitting on the toilet.
Binoculars.
Okay. One day I was sitting on the toilet, and we had this great big window right by the toilet. And you can look right out over to the ocean. I'm sitting on this toilet watching for approximately 20 minutes to a half an hour. Mm-hmm. A 50-foot, 50-ton humpback whale breaching mm-hmm. a half mile offshore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't want to leave the toilet.
No.
It was such a unique situation. But that's the kind of thing we experience almost on a daily basis, and not just with the wildlife. The Marshall Point Lighthouse is this grand place of pilgrimage where people from across the world would go to experience and to witness the ocean. We've had people come up to us and say, "Excuse me, sir, is this the Atlantic Ocean right here?" Mm-hmm. You know, people 50, 60, 70 years old seeing the ocean for the very first time. It's mm-hmm. And you become part of that because you're there witnessing it and you're interacting with them.
And with photographers, of course, there's this integral part of their success, which is understanding the qualities of light. And you were in a place where, for example, you would see uniquely and in great detail and in constant change the quality of light on the ocean, on the water, the night sky, all of these things that are part of this incredible ambiance which surrounds us. And you had the opportunity to actually capture it in your camera.
Yes. I don't think there's a single entity in this world that could afford to pay a photographer to create the body of work that I created. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm not bragging. I'm not saying my work is that exceptional. It's just that to take any kind of wonderful photograph, the first step of your creative process is to be there. Mm. You want to capture a beautiful sunrise at Sandy Stream Pond in Baxter State Park in the middle of June, you have to be at that location at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. So that's the very first step. And here I am living at this location, which is as grand as can be, and I don't have to sit in a hotel. I don't have to worry about my meals. I don't have to worry about being cold or hot. I was 100% comfortable and was able to capture anything and everything that I was able to see.
So what then brought that blissful chapter to an end?
Well, like most people, we want to be homeowners. Mm-hmm. And that's really the simple answer.
I always dreamed of living in a lighthouse. Tom always dreamed of living in a log cabin in the woods.
It was just time.
Yeah.
It was time. You know, living at Marshall Point Lighthouse was like living in a fishbowl also, because the land was owned by the town and it was open to the public during daylight hours. Where we live now, we don't even have any window dressings. We have no shades or anything. Mm-hmm. We got 100% privacy. We don't have to worry about people peeking in on us or anything of that nature.
We went from one extreme to another, like Tom said, from living in a fishbowl to having extreme privacy. We loved living at Marshall Point. We were in no hurry to move on. But as Tom said, we also knew at some point we'd like to have our own home.
Yeah.
And so we started, while we lived at Marshall Point, we started looking for land. We knew we wanted to stay in Maine. We started looking for land all over Maine. We weren't particular where we wanted to live.
We weren't particular of where we wanted to live, but we were very particular what type of land we wanted.
Well, yeah, that's why.
Because we wanted to create a wildlife studio.
Right. So
a wildlife photography studio.
We were looking for, a wooded land, maybe a little stream, maybe a little pond. We had all kinds of things on our wish list, and we just started looking. And long story short, we happen upon this land in Whitefield, Maine. It was 70 acres, and we knew nothing about Whitefield. We went and looked at it, and it was exactly what we had envisioned. There was a small little woods road that had been put in. We could walk down. We walked down about 900 feet. There was this small little pond. And right next to the pond, there was a little clearing. It looked like maybe somebody was planning on building there, but never did. And then in the back of the property, a little further back, is the East Branch of the Eastern River. It was everything that we had hoped for. And the price was within our budget. And so we bought it. I think that was in 1997.
Yeah, I don't even think we looked at the complete land when we bought it.
No, we didn't.
We determined what was on the land by viewing and analyzing topographical maps and other maps. And we knew nothing about Whitefield. I don't even know if we even heard of Whitefield, Maine, to be honest with you. And and we did zero investigating into the community. We just bought the land almost without any knowledge of the area.
It just felt right. It felt...
I've
been in that place where you see something and your heart tells you this is it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it worked out great.
How did you build a house? There was no house.
We hired a contractor to build a log cabin, a small log cabin. It's less than 1,500 square feet. Sometimes we wish we maybe had one or two extra rooms, but it's really nice. One of the first things we told all of the contractors who came on the property is, do not cut down a single tree unless you absolutely have to.
Right.
So the forest comes within 6 feet of the cabin. We have very large trees that are only 6 feet from the cabin. It sounds like maybe it would be a little suffocating to some people, but to us, we feel like the branches of the trees overhanging the cabin are embracing us and hugging us and keeping us safe and warm and secure in the forest.
Well, it's an absolute contrast to where you were before.
Yes.
Oh,
though,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that too is now you have to start all over again. I mean, you have to explore it. You have to understand it. You have to adjust your emotional and even your physical responses to this new place.
Right.
Sort of, I mean, it seems so clear and so simple in a way. And it's so blessed by the fact that you found this first place that's extraordinary. Now you found another place that's extraordinary.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. How did then you address that? You had a whole system of confrontation and embrace with the ocean. Now you're an entirely different ecosystem.
It was fun, and it still is fun.
We've
been living there for 22 years. I have been a still professional photographer for 45 years. I'm 66 years old. I've been involved with the forest and nature and wildlife for most of my life. And almost every day, we see, smell, or experience something new in this forest.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is unfathomable. I would think after all these years and all these photographs I've created that I would know everything by now.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps me alive. It keeps my heart and brain going. And every day, you know, just for example, just a few days ago, we were sitting near the cabin. I think we were just relaxing. And we heard a commotion 50 feet up in a tree, only about 20 feet from where we were sitting. And we glanced up in the tree, and we noticed something falling out of the tree. and it landed only 20 feet from where we were sitting. And it's at that point we realized it was a chipmunk. And it stayed still for a few seconds. We thought maybe it was dead. But it got up and ran into the forest and disappeared. And then we heard more commotion up in the same tree, 50 feet up in the tree. We look up there, and there's another animal climbing down the trunk of the tree. It turned out to be a weasel. Mm. The weasel had climbed up this tree chasing this chipmunk. And the chipmunk had only one means of escape, and that was to jump 50 feet off of this tree.
Right. And lived to tell the tale to his little chipmunk.
Lived for a few minutes. We don't know how long it survived. It did run away safely. But this just an example of the incredible things you can witness when you live in the middle of a forest.
Yeah. Now, are you coming and going again, or are you recluse?
Both.
Yeah.
You know, when we started doing some of our wildlife photography and begun advocating for wildlife at the same time, I was quite a recluse. You know, you don't gather the wisdom of the nature and wildlife like I have by going out and socializing with people. You know, you have to go out into the woods, and it's not a group activity. So I spent a lot of time by myself in the woods. But when I decided to advocate more for the well-being of the environment and wildlife, I came to the realization, and it wasn't an easy decision to make, but I came to the realization that I have to get myself out there. I can't just show the photographs. I have to talk. And I've noticed that pattern with many wildlife photographers where they, you know, a lot of photographers, wildlife photographers, get into the wildlife photography because they want to help the animals in the environment. And they believe that if they create a wildlife photograph of a whale and publish it, that they're doing their job, that's the end of the job. And I've seen that many photographers approach it from that method. And I've come to the determination, in my opinion, that that's a total failure. You have to get involved. You have to speak. You have to get dirty. You have to get ugly. You have to get threats. You know, we advocate so much for wildlife that we receive threats.
So tell me about that. Were you sponsored? Did you join a certain organization? How did you create your path for advocacy?
Well, we did join some organizations, but we eventually left them, and we're just two independent lay people who have the skill and this wisdom that we've developed over the decades. But we also, you know, we have this,
and passion.
You know, we have this knowledge. We spend so much time watching and observing wildlife that it places us in an incredibly unique position in the sense that we've seen so many incredible, interesting behaviors. The only conclusion we can come to is that Maine, as far as the wildlife is concerned, has just as much beauty and fascination with the wildlife as any other state or country on the planet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I find most people don't know that. But Lee and I knew that. And creating the film A Piece of Forest was our way of trying to educate the people more in this state of what they have as neighbors.
I want to go back, though, a little bit earlier than that. I definitely want to talk about the film. But I still want to look at the idea, because now you had a pond. Mm-hmm. You had a river. You were in an entirely different ecosystem that connects with the ocean. What drained into your pond ultimately ended up in the ocean at some point down the line.
Yeah.
But it required you to shift your perspective.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How did that work? Did it just the landscape tell you and you had no choice, or did you make changes?
Within a couple of months of living in our log cabin in Whitefield, one evening, Tom said, you know, I'd love to take a whole year off just to photograph wildlife on our 70 acres here. And he said, what I'd love to do is create one acceptable image to represent each week of an entire year just on this property. And I thought it was such a brilliant idea. I said, then just do it. So it was
a year
January,
of looking closer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. January 1st, 2004, we embarked on what is now Biomaine River, A Year of Looking Closely, our second book. And it's a very simple book, but very stunning in that it shows one photograph of nature or wildlife to represent each week of the calendar year. Tom wrote an introduction. I wrote an afterword. And it's, you know, it's just very reflective of when you slow down and get connected to your environment.
And how complicated is it? I mean, it's a complicated ecosystem.
It's not complicated, at least not for us. It never has been.
But it is a complicated, biodiverse thing. And to profile it responsibly, it must have an underlying structure that evolved.
Yeah, well, Lee and I can speak without talking. She knows what I want. I know what she wants. Because we basically knew who we were and where our directions were headed, where our hearts and souls are.
Trusting ourselves, trusting each other, having a lot of patience, and high ethical standards with our work. And what I mean by that is...
Not just with life.
Yes, that's true.
Live a good life, be happy, don't hurt anybody.
And we live a very simple life too. Mm-hmm. Those 70 acres, belongs to the wildlife. They've allowed us to have this little tiny footprint where we have our cabin. But as far as we're concerned, that's their home first. Therefore, we always keep in mind what's best for the wildlife. Mm-hmm. We try to be as non-intrusive as possible. We sit in camouflage photography blinds for hours on end. We do not bait the animals. We don't call them. We don't do anything to harass them. We let them be comfortable with us and approach us. And by doing that, we've created a very trusting relationship with them. We are not friends with them. We don't talk to them. But they're comfortable with us. You know, we step foot out the door. If there's a deer right there, it'll take off. But when we're quiet, they're comfortable, and they behave naturally, and that's what we've been able to capture.
There's a scene in the film near the ending where a doe white-tailed deer exits the forest and enters a beaver pond meadow, and right behind, trailing right behind this doe is a newborn fawn. Now, Lee is sitting in a blind on this edge of this beaver pond meadow, and she's watching and filming this doe who we know, we recognize this doe. Sometimes if we can identify an animal easily, we will name the animal. So we knew this animal, it was a named animal. And in the film, you can see the animal, the doe interacting with the fawn, and no one would know this except Lee and I, because we're the filmers, and we know what was going on and what was happening at that moment. But during this segment in the film, which lasts maybe a couple of minutes, the doe glances over to look at Lee on two occasions. And one of those glances is after she led the fawn even closer to Lee. At one point, I think the fawn and the doe were only 50 feet away, and you can see the doe quickly, really quickly, and very subtle, look at and glance at Lee, just as if to acknowledge, I know you're there, and you know I'm here, and everything's copacetic.
Right. And you've seen her before.
Oh,
and
yes.
You've watched the fawn grow up.
Yes, there's been instances where we've been able to watch a white-tailed deer from being only a few days old to death.
I have a story. It's my little epiphany. I was in France, and I was in a river, and there was an old fisherman that was living on this fishing boat in Brittany. And we were invited aboard, and he spoke Breton. And he served us a liqueur and 190 proof. And we got a bit tipsy. It was time to go. I come out of the hatch, and sitting right there on the deck is this seagull. And I'm looking at the seagull, and the seagull is looking at me. The old fisherman comes up out of the cabin, and I turn to him, and I just sort of gesture, well, here's the seagull. And in French, he says to me, I knew his grandfather. And I said, that's it.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Maybe his great-grandfather. Maybe he lost count. I mean, the idea of being that familiar with an animal purely in the wild, over the generations, over time.
Yeah.
Is what a brilliant thing.
It's a treat.
It's a gift.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists, makers and exemplars, whose work, specific to the Maine landscape and culture, gives insight into our special quality of life. My guests today are Leanne and Tom Zelog, and we are discussing their new feature-length film on the wildlife and wilderness in Maine, as well as their previous publications on living by the sea and along a river course. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfurs.org.
I would say that of all the animals we've encountered in the 22 years we've lived in the cabin, probably less than 1 or 2% we've named. Because only 1 or 2% can we continue to identify day in and day out.
And the reason we name them is when we see one, if I see a deer, I can say, oh, you know, so-and-so is here, Tom, instead of trying to describe the deer. We name trees, we name landmarks. So if we see, you know, let's say we see an owl fly in, we can say, Tom, on the fern tree, there's an owl. So Tom will know exactly where the fern tree is and look real quickly.
Yeah.
So we name a lot of different things.
It's a lot easier than saying, hey, you know that branch fell off 6 weeks ago during that big snowstorm? Well, there's an owl on it right now.
Right.
You know, it's easier to say, hey, there's an owl on fern.
On fern, right.
Native people have anthropomorphized nature and animals for millennia.
Yeah.
They've been given names. They share their stories.
Right.
It's not new.
Yeah.
It's just forgotten.
Yeah.
There's only been a handful of animals that we've known for an extended period of time. I think 1 or 2 white-tailed deer. One particular barred owl that we knew for 10 years, which was very, very fascinating. We got to know it quite well. We knew its behavior.
This is one of the great problems of this having a radio program, an audio program, is that nobody can see anything. They have to interpret it.
That's designed so people can go and spend $15.
Well, that's my point.
You know, and make a contribution to my beer fund.
How can they find the books? Say it right now and we'll put it up on the website. How can they buy these books? Are they in the bookstores?
I think at this point you can order them in the bookstores. By Downey's Books.
Downey's Books.
Yes,
oh,
right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, definitely they'll be up.
You can find them. Yeah, you might have to make a little effort, but they're still being published. They're still being sold.
I'll send you some links.
Great. Yeah. That would be terrific. Yeah. We'll put them up on our website
Thank
as
you.
Well. Okay. Yeah. Now let's move on to the current project. Not so current, but in a way very different. It's an extrapolation of what you've done. It seems to me that by virtue of moving from a book and a static image and words, you're now moving to an entirely different medium. It's photography, but it's motion. And it's so much more able to absorb the fullness of the experience over time. I mean, the photograph is 1 minute, 1 second. A sequence is 5 minutes or whatever it may be, and then it's juxtaposed, and then it's edited against, or then it dissolves into something else. Did you have to learn how to make films?
No.
Ah.
No, I did not. I had to learn how to do the post-production, but the actual production of the imagery came extraordinarily natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
Even to Lee, Lee does have to spend a lot of time training herself on how to use the equipment and how to approach the subject matter differently. The filming of it was actually quite simple.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that was the fun part. That was the
give me a couple of examples of success or surprise.
Okay, well, an event that Lee encountered. We had just had this beautiful snowfall, and the snow was sticking to the trees, and the forest looked really beautiful. And she decided to try to take some landscape video for the film.
You know those. Yeah. Beautiful mornings with fresh snow.
Yeah, so she went out near Bear Pond, and she went out with a walkie-talkie, and I had the other walkie-talkie so we could communicate with each other. I don't even know why I think they were new, and we were testing them because we don't normally use them. No. But anyways, she went out, and all she had was one lens, a wide-angle lens, to do her landscape filming. And she discovered a weasel that was poking its head in and out of this huge dead tree trunk. I mean, a very large tree trunk that had been rotting in our woods for a long time, and all these holes and crevices were created in it. So she called me on the the walkie-talkie and said, hey, what did I just discover the weasel? Can you bring a telephoto lens? And so I went out, got dressed in the cold, and bought her this telephoto lens. I bought her a chair so she could sit there and wait for the weasel. And she got this real stunning video of this beautiful creature in this beautiful environment all covered in snow. And that was a pretty cool surprise.
Yeah, it was very surprised,
You know, we didn't expect that. Yeah. And, you know, almost any time when you create an image, whether it's still or video, of wildlife in Maine, it's always a surprise, because it's so difficult to do.
Right.
Let's see, where did I get surprised? How about the bobcat in the film?
Oh, yeah, all right,
I mean, bobcats are common, very common in Maine, but extraordinarily difficult to observe because of their cat-like habits and nocturnal habits. And if you see one, consider yourself extremely lucky. If you film one, consider yourself extraordinarily lucky. Go and buy a lotto ticket that day.
Yeah, we never did that.
We encountered a bobcat, and it was the same bobcat, several times over the course of several weeks that allowed us to film it. That was a surprise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that actually was among the first clips that we created for the film. Yeah. Tom had just switched, maybe within a year or 12 months, he had just switched from film camera to digital, which there was a learning curve there, and he was experimenting with the
videography.
Yeah, videography, and was amazed. And this bobcat showed up, and that was kind of the beginning. It was almost a sign.
I had always wanted to experiment. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, no, that's right. It was almost a sign that it was meant for us to do this film.
Yeah, I had always wanted to create a film. But I just never thought I would have the time, and I surely didn't want to make the investment in the equipment. But as most people know these days, when you buy a high-end still camera, they have video capabilities. Mm-hmm. And the video capabilities, especially the high-end professional cameras, is outstanding. Mm-hmm. And that's what I discovered when I bought my first digital camera. So one day I went out in the field to test this new digital camera, and one of the things I tested was the video aspect of it. And when we got home and downloaded the video on the computer and watched it, we were stunned at the quality and how beautiful it looked. And it was that moment that the possibility of us maybe creating a film is more realistic now.
Right.
So now you have enormous amounts of footage. What was the organizing principle for the film?
Well, it was going to be seasonal. We were going to go through the seasons, which is a pretty basic standard script for a wildlife film. But you can't create a story when you're a wildlife photographer. I can't get an animal to sit in a gorgeous light and behave the certain way I want them to. You know, like a still life photographer who has a studio, they can adjust all the lights and they can adjust all the compositions and things. You can't do that when you're a nature photographer. So you depend on serendipity, you depend on luck, and you know that the only way you're going to get this done is to spend a lot of time in the field. It's the only way you're going to do it. You're not going to walk in the field. You're not in Yellowstone National Park. You're not going to walk into the field and see and grab video of great flocks of geese and grizzly bears and wolves. It's not going to happen in Maine. You have to work your butt off and sit in the woods for a long, long time. Long time.
So I respect, admire, acknowledge your perseverance. On the other hand, look at it this way. If you're a novelist, for example, and you're facing a white paper, what do? Basically, you go into your inventory of images and you arrange them. And you can arrange them badly, or you can arrange them under certain laws of narrative.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you tell a story.
I understand now your question better.
Yeah. I think the other thing that perhaps would be helpful is one thing I believe we knew from the get-go is we wanted to be very intentional. We wanted this to be a quiet film. We wanted it to be as natural as possible. So one of the intentional decisions we made was it was going to be minimal maybe no narration. I think originally we talked about
originally we were going to go with no narration. Yeah. Then we discovered that two things. One, that's going to be extremely difficult to pull it off. And two, it's going to be extremely difficult to convince the viewers and the audience that this is a film they want to see. Because it's unconventional.
Yeah. And particularly also if you're going to use it for advocacy.
Yeah.
Because
it becomes
one of your most powerful tools for advocacy.
That's what I was just going to say. There's certain messages in that film that were very poignant.
They're subtle, but they're there.
But they're there. But we really had the goal of allowing the audience to experience nature and wildlife as it's meant to.
In your case, though, you've indicated that you want to use your work to advocate. If I'm in the theater and you're there, and after the program is open, what would be the best question that a member of the audience could ask
you? Wow, that's a nice question.
What do we hope to achieve with a piece of forest?
We've been asked that, and it's not my best question.
Okay, well, I'll answer that, and then you share what your best question.
I'll think about it.
We want people to realize that we share this earth with other species. Mm-hmm. The human species is not the only species making a living on this earth. The human species is destroying this earth. Mm-hmm. We need to realize that we share this earth with many species. Every bird, every fish, every tick, every mosquito, every mammal, every blade of grass, moss, tree. We know from all the discussion about climate change that our earth is in trouble. We are the generation that can save the earth, or we can be the generation that destroys the earth. Tom and I are choosing to try to help save the earth and save all species. We are connected. We are part of Mother Nature. We are so disconnected as the human species. We need to reconnect with nature. We need to appreciate and respect the wildlife that we share this earth with. And we need to protect habitat for them. We need to protect their life. And in doing so, it's going to protect the human species as well.
So the message, I think, is extremely important. It's a spiritual message, and it's a political message, and it's an ecological message.
I think it would be interesting if someone asks me, do I walk the walk? I talk the talk, but do I walk the walk, and how do I walk the walk?
Mm-hmm. Tom, you talk the talk. Well, how do you walk the walk?
When we built our home, and even as we live today at our home, everything really revolves around peace and serenity for us humans who live there, but for the wildlife and the trees and the water and the sky and the clouds. We're very quiet and slow moving when we're on our property. It doesn't matter whether we're actually doing filming or still photography or watching the television or perhaps I'm mowing the lawn or something.
Mowing the lawn. We don't mow our lawn.
Well, weed whacker. I use a weed whacker. I used to mow the lawn.
Yeah.
When we first moved in, we used only manual tools because we wanted to be quiet. But we realized as we were aging that we did need a few power tools, and we do have a few power tools. We don't use them a lot. But we were quiet. And that's a very important aspect of getting close to wildlife and gaining some serenity in your heart and soul. There have been times where we're scheduled to go to a meeting and we have to be somewhere, and we realize that there's an animal standing next to our automobile, and we don't want to disturb it because it's doing something unique or special. Maybe it's with one of its babies or something. And we'll stay in the house and be late for that meeting. That's just a small example of how we try to live in relationship with our nearest neighbors, which is the wildlife.
So how do I get to see this film?
Right now it's only being shown in theaters. We're trying to take advantage of the theaters, the great small community theaters we have in the state, and showing them in these little towns. And we've just been blown away by what critics are saying, what the audience has been saying. I say this without sounding like I'm boasting and bragging, but we succeeded 110% with this film. We captured behavior that most people in Maine haven't seen and will never see, and that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to capture these unique moments, and even if it's a few seconds in the forest so that people can see this and witness these types of behaviors. And just maybe hopefully somebody out there will make an iota of an effort to perhaps save a little piece of land or save an animal or something.
How does your work, how does it evoke a kind of larger pattern that adds up to something special to the place we live?
What I like to do right now, and which we are doing to a certain extent, is using our film, A Piece of Forest, as a vehicle to reel people in, and then we can vocalize to them our concerns of our environment in Maine. Mm-hmm.
You asked a few minutes ago about how we walk the walk. It's not just by a Maine River or our point of view or a piece of forest, but we are strong advocates for creating the original 3.2 million acre proposed Maine Woods National Park. The Katahdin Woods and Waters, the monument, National Monument, is a perfect foundation for something larger and grander that not only Maine deserves, but our country deserves. There's 10 million acres in Maine's Great North Woods. If they are not protected, we will lose a priceless ecosystem forever. And the proposed Maine Woods National Park is 3.2 million acres. It would be such a gift to the world to have that protected as a national park.
You'd ask how we walk the walk. We don't eat meat.
Do you forage off your own land?
No, we do not. I wish we did.
There's so many
we have books on homesteading and things like that.
There's so many things we wish.
But
it's okay.
We're only two people.
No. It's okay.
Yeah.
We're all failures in that regard. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
My guests today have been Leanne and Tom Zelog, the creators of a new feature-length documentary on wildlife and wildness in Maine. Their film, A Piece of Forest, will be shown in various locations across the state this summer. For a calendar of times and places, visit their website, apieceofforest.com. My guests next time will be Cipriley Good and Kevin Johnson, curators at the Penobscot Marine Museum, to explore the history of the sardine fishery in Maine, focus of a new exhibit at the museum in Searsport in summer 2026. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a Leeds Island Books audio project, hosted by Peter Neal, produced by Tricia Badger, theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music. Visit pointedfirs.org and the WERU archive for the full catalog of Conversations from the Pointed Firs.